Well, good morning, TNC family. I am standing in our sanctuary, and I'm talking to two people in this room who are helping me record this podcast. And I'm talking to you, wherever you are, listening to this podcast. And while I 1,000,000% miss seeing you here, I'm grateful that none of us believe that a Sunday morning church service alone defines who we are. Because we are a 24/7 church, which means if we don't meet here for an hour on Sunday morning, we still have another 23/7 to be the church. And so, in the middle of this coronavirus era, we will continue to find ways to love and serve and connect and grow and step up and step out and walk in step with the one we follow. And in some important ways, it's actually been a good last 7 days, because I've had the privilege of receiving and sending hundreds of texts between family and friends and neighbors, and FaceTiming several of you, and of talking with dozens of you on the phone. And I had a wonderful WebEx small group meeting on Thursday evening. And we have a church Facebook forum that I hope you're participating in daily. And we are all together reading daily through the New Testament Gospel of Mark. Mark, who was a co-worker and friend of the Apostle Peter and the Apostle Paul. There's an early historian, Papias, who suggested that Mark met with Peter in Rome and wrote down story after story after story from Peter's eyewitness experiences with Jesus. And then arranged these stories into his account, his gospel, his biography of Jesus. And I hope you are committed to and are participating in these daily readings. About 89 of you received the syllabus via a direct text from me. Others of you have accessed it from our Facebook page. And of course, anyone listening to this can do so as well. Now, I want to teach for a few minutes from Mark chapter 4, in verse 35, where Mark tells us that one day when evening came, Jesus said to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." Because there's always another side. A new opportunity, a fresh place, a new destination that God wants to journey with you towards. Verse 36, so leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. And there were also other boats with him. Verse 37, a furious squall came up. A huge storm, and the waves poured into the boat, threatening to sink it. Jesus was in the stern, head on a pillow, sleeping. So the disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" The Message translation renders it, "Teacher, is it nothing to you that we're going down?" And if you read Facebook posts and Twitter tweets and news reports and blogs, then you know that folks are worried that we in the United States and we in the world are going down. because we're in the middle of a storm. And people are afraid, understandably. Government and health officials are telling us it's dangerous to gather in groups of more than 10. And even then, to stay 6 feet apart. The stock market is tanking, businesses are closing, and economists are predicting we may reach unemployment rates of as much as 20%. I know folks personally who are legitimately worried about losing their jobs. And the fear extends beyond jobs and physical health. I've been in communication with people who ask me outright, "Pastor, could this be a sign of the end times?" Some Christians have gone to social media and posted bizarre, historically untenable, textually irresponsible claims about the coronavirus being linked to passages in the Bible. Actual tweets like, quote, "The coronavirus has been brought on by the beast that is talked about in the book of Revelation." Quote, "Widespread pestilence and plague is prophesied in the book of Revelation. We are living in the last days." Quote, "This is the arrival of one of the four horsemen of the apocalypse described in Revelation 6. And all of this reminds me of something that the great theologian G.K. Chesterton wrote. He said, "Though St. John," who wrote the book of Revelation, "though St. John saw many strange monsters in his visions, he saw no creatures so wild as one of his own commentators." And so we're in the middle of a storm, because coronavirus is a storm. But there's another storm afoot. Fear. Fear is a storm. Fear is a virus. And when you catch the fear virus, when you get caught in the fear storm, immobilizing worry, inflated self-interest, hoarding, mistrust, emotional choices, stressed biological systems, they all take over. And so I want to share with you now three things that the virus of fear, that the storm of fear must be met with. Three things that the storm of fear must be met with. And number one, here's number one. Fear must be met with perspective. Fear must be met with perspective. Of course, in terms of medical crises, the list is long throughout human history. Two examples: the bubonic plague in the 14th century is estimated to have killed 50% of Europe's population, killing 100 million people. The Spanish flu pandemic of 1918 infected an estimated 500 million people worldwide, about a third of our planet's population, and killed an estimated 35 million victims, including 675,000 Americans. I'm saying present fear must be met by past perspective. I read this week these words, quote, "Desolating earthquakes, sweeping fires," and of course I immediately thought when I read that of the Australian bushfires and the fires in the western U.S., "Desolating earthquakes, sweeping fires, distressing poverty, political recklessness, private bankruptcy, and widespread immorality abound in these last days." And the author went on to warn that the Lord was returning imminently. The author was William Miller. The words written in 1843. Perspective. I'm reading a really interesting book right now, simply called 1968. Subtitle, The Year That Rocked the World. The year before that, 1967, of course, was a year of extraordinary uncertainty and violence. 109 U.S. cities faced violent protest and riots, including the Detroit riot, which left 41 dead, 2,000 injured, 1,700 stores looted, and 1,600 buildings set ablaze, which prompted the New York Times headline on January 1, 1968. World bids adieu to a violent year. But 1968 opened with the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, and there were 46 U.S. combat deaths a day on average in 1968. And the U.S. spent $3 billion a month in Vietnam. And in 1968, Dow Chemical produced something called napalm, used against soldiers, civilians, and the landscape in Vietnam. Napalm, a jelly-like substance that can be shot at considerable distance under pressure and burns with intense heat and sticks to its target and wreaks total havoc. 1968. That was the year President Johnson appealed to the American public to curtail plans for foreign travel in order to make Americans spend money in the U.S., not overseas, to help the U.S. economy. And Johnson, who was expected to win the nomination and was likely to get reelected, on March 31 announced unexpectedly that he would not run for reelection, throwing the country into political uncertainty. And April 4, Dr. King is murdered. And of course, that symbolized an entire array of unspeakable things going on in our country. And on June 6, Robert Kennedy is murdered. And the year ends with George Wallace, a blatant racist, getting 13.5% of the vote in five states. And if you think I'm overinflating the fear and tension in our country and our world in 1968, then you need to reread your history. And my point is not, hey, we've come through scary times before, so just relax, everybody. No. My point is, let's give 2020 some perspective, because we've come through hard times before. So instead of giving in to the storm of fear, let's figure out how we came through it before. Let's learn from failures and mistakes. Let's learn from successes and things we got right, so we can come together again through this. See, fear must be met with perspective. Of course, the great King David makes this point in scriptures when the nation of Israel is afraid of the giant Goliath. You remember the story. No one will face the giant in the valley of Elah. But David says, come on, friends, let me give you some perspective. I fought a lion. I fought a bear. This giant isn't that different. And new community, what I'm saying is, this week, when you get a panicked text or an email of alarm or have a religious figure manipulate the scriptures this week, please understand that this kind of fear-based perspective and fear-based theology and fear-based scripture reading, it's not new. And so fear must be met with perspective. Second, fear must be met with love. Fear must be met with love. 1948 was 3 years after the dropping of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And fear was ever present that we would experience another atomic event in our world. And the arms race was on. And so in 1948, the great C.S. Lewis wrote an essay called On Living in the Atomic Age. Jeff King, who is our men's ministry leader here, he shared this with me last week. And I want you to listen now to a few of C.S. Lewis's words, written 72 years ago, and yet so timely for today. Lewis writes, "In one way, we think a great deal too much of the atomic bomb." And by the way, when I read the word atomic bomb here, you would probably be wise to replace it with the coronavirus. In one way, we think a great deal too much of the coronavirus. Lewis asks, how are we to live in an atomic age? Well, he writes, as you would have lived in the 16th century when the plague visited London almost every year. Or as you would have lived in a Viking age when raiders from Scandinavia might land and cut your throat any night. Or indeed, as you are already living in an age of cancer, an age of syphilis, an age of paralysis, an age of air raids, an age of railway accidents, an age of motor accidents. In other words, Lewis is saying, let's not let fear of a new danger stop us from living and loving well. Lewis goes on, quote, it is perfectly ridiculous to go about whimpering and drawing long faces because scientists have added one more chance of painful and premature death to a world which already bristled with such chances, and in which death itself was not a chance at all, but a certainty. He writes, if we're all going to be destroyed by the atomic bomb, let that bomb, when it comes, find us doing sensible and human things. Praying, working, teaching, reading, listening to music, bathing the children, playing tennis, chatting with our friends, not huddled like frightened sheep and thinking about bombs. He writes, they may break our bodies, but they need not dominate our minds. In other words, new community, what does it mean for us to pray, work, teach, read, listen, bathe the children, play, connect in this time of fear? It means we keep on loving. So let me suggest some specific ways. First, I think love means we respect and follow the advice and counsel of elected officials and healthcare experts. Because embedded in this definition of love is respect and humility for those who are trying to help us through this crisis. This is not the time to lean into conspiracy theories and brag about how you are, I'm my own man, I'm my own woman, no one tells me what to do. Come on. That's not love. Second, love means we reach out to our friends and neighbors. Parents who suddenly have to find 2 weeks of childcare. hourly workers who will be experiencing small or no paychecks this month. Folks facing legitimate food insecurity. I contacted our partners at North Fulton Community Charities last week, and what they most need, they said, is money. And so I went online last week and I donated to help them as they help so many families. And you can do the same. See, love means don't only ask what are my needs, but rather what are your needs. Third, love means that we're going to refuse to hoard. Now, if you've already done this, purchasing dozens of face masks and 100 bottles of hand sanitizer and 200 rolls of toilet paper, then let me tell you it's time to donate those supplies back to the public services and people that need them the most right now. Some of you know, I love Mahatma yellow rice. It comes in these small yellow packets that sit in a neat line inside a cardboard display box at a grocery store. It is so good, especially if you add like salsa and some beans and chips. I probably eat this Mahatma yellow rice multiple times every week. But with grocery stores' shelves largely empty, I've gone into several stores and found that all of the Mahatma yellow rice is gone. There's a Walmart near my house, and for three straight days I went in, and among the things I did, I checked the rice aisle. Gone. Finally, on Wednesday of last week, I again went down the rice aisle, and I saw from a distance some yellow packaging. And my heart started to race, and I got nearer, and there it was. One large cardboard box with six packets of Mahatma yellow rice still there. Six packets, that's like 12 meals. And so I reached up with both hands, and you know how many I grabbed? You know it, right? I took one packet because there's at least five other folks who love Mahatma yellow rice. See, love means we refuse to hoard. And fourth, love means that we see opportunities amid the obstacles. For years, as a pastor, I have heard people say over and over and over again, if only I had time, if only I had time to develop an exercise habit, if only I had time to start my morning with some scripture reading and prayer, if only I had time to clean my garage or that closet, if only I had time to build more into my kids. Well, friends, you've got time. And time is the perfect recipe for love. Because love requires time. Love family and love friends. And care for your body and your mind and your soul. I'm telling you, fear needs perspective, but fear also must be met with love. And so in this era that we are in, will you prioritize love? Finally, third, fear must be met with faith. Fear must be met with faith. And the question here is, where do you turn when the storms of life arise? Let's go back to Mark chapter 4. A furious squall came up, a huge storm. And waves poured into the boat, threatening to sink it. But Jesus was in the stern, head on a pillow, sleeping. So the disciples woke him and said, "Teacher, is it nothing to you that we're going down?" Verse 39. So Jesus got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And the wind died down, and it was completely calm. Now, notice, they are still on the water. There's still a lot of water in the boat that needs bailed out. And the mast still has a rip right through it. But the storm is over. I'm reading a book right now called The Third Door by a guy named Alex Banayan. It's about uncovering how the world's most successful people launched their careers. And in the book, Banayan talks about when he sat down with Maya Angelou. And he says, quote, "She told me to take out a notepad and write down a sentence and to never forget it." So he says he took out a notepad and a pen, and he was prepared to write down something. And then he said, she said to him, quote, "Always remember, every storm runs out of rain. Every storm runs out of rain. Every storm will run out of rain." And it's just true. And so this storm, this coronavirus storm, it too will run out of rain. And we don't know when yet, but we can choose to have faith in the storm soother. We can lean into his wisdom for living and his vision for loving. We can choose to trust in the hope he offers and the peace he provides. And we can choose to be the church that he established in the days following his resurrection. Harriet Beecher Stowe was a writer in the 19th century. And in 1852, she sought to communicate the anti-slavery message to many who had blocked their ears to sermons and protests. And so she wrote a novel, Uncle Tom's Cabin, which sold 200,000 copies its first year, and as much as any other force, moved a nation toward change. 10 years later, when Stowe met President Abraham Lincoln in 1862, he famously said to her, "So, you are the woman who wrote the book that started this great war." Because one person, using her gifts to combat a national slavery virus, spoke up for love and for justice and helped to bring about the end to a centuries-long storm in this nation. And it just makes me wonder what will be said of you and me in 1 year or maybe in 10 years on the other side of this storm when it runs out of rain. Oh, TNC. The new community. You're the church that showed me Jesus during the 2020 pandemic. Oh, you were the one who, when I was hungry, gave me something to eat. And when I was thirsty, gave me something to drink. Oh, you were the church that mobilized the community around love and teamwork and hope. You are the one who called me and served me and listened to me and helped me bail water and helped me pray and learn and grow. You are the one who wrote the book that ended the fear and helped calm the storm. My prayer is that we may be that church today.